I probably don't need to tell you, but I'm sure that many, if not all of you, are up on one of the newest crazes in our culture. They're referred to as gender reveal parties, and they've gone from the simple to the off the rails, sort of the same way as the Sweet 16 parties, if you please. Because of advancements in ultrasound technology, you know that we're able to determine the gender of children earlier and earlier, and so we party. Now, parents assemble family and friends. And they do this with great fanfare to reveal the gender of their child for the first time, to the joy, usually, for the joy of all in attendance. Now, I'm going to leave aside what we may think or not think about gender reveal parties, but it struck me that our text today, though certainly not a gender reveal party, is a revealing of the most profound sort. It's a different sort, but a profound sort nonetheless. And though you might expect everyone to be filled with joy at this reveal, not all are. Some are quite less than happy, quite less than filled with joy. And that's by design, because one of the things that Matthew does throughout the length of his gospel is create contrast. He continually creates contrast between groups of people for whom the coming of Jesus is a joy-filled time. But for other people, it creates great anxiety, even threateningly so. And he introduces this idea of this tension, of this contrast, right here, right at the very beginning, and then just continues to unfold it all the way to the very end of his gospel. Through natural and special revelation, I'll talk more about that in a moment, Jesus, already, as we saw last week, revealed to Mary and Joseph, is now revealed in one of the 10 ways that he's described in these first two chapters of Matthew as the King of the Jews. But not just the King of the Jews, but King to all the nations as well, as represented by the so-called wise men, foreign astrologers, if you please, as well as to a very threatened king with unusual power. And he's going to use that power in grotesque ways for the advancement of his own kingdom, or so he thinks. Matthew chapter 2 is a travelogue. It's a triptych, if you please. And verses 1 to 12 are the first leg of this travelogue, which describes a journey along the providential pathways of God. And it moves from word to worship. That's the movement. This isn't three points in a poem this morning. This is a rather smoothly moving narrative from the revelation of the word to the action that comes when that revelation is received, namely the worship of the one who is the object of the revealed word. And so that's the trajectory I want to take you along this morning, along this first leg of this travelogue. The second leg is next week, and we go international next week, crossing geographic boundaries. And we see that our king is really a refugee king that comes from a foreign land, a sobering reality in our world today. So today, we're going to look at this first leg, describing the journey of God's providential pathways from word to worship. That's the movement. Then within that movement from word to worship, we will show you how the contrasts by design, by Matthew, are used to get our attention and to ask ourselves, where are we relative to the revelation of Jesus Christ in our own lives? So what I want you to imagine here now is, God help me, a TV screen. I just said that, didn't I? And you're watching a movie, and there's a certain sequence of events that occurs, and then the screen fades to black, and then across the screen, it says 1 to 2 years later. That's what's happening right now where we are in Matthew chapter 2 and verse 1. 1 to 2 years later. So super technically, this is not a Christmas text. Christmas has come and gone. But that's a reference to Matthew's selectivity. That's not an unusual thing. You perhaps have read a biography of one of your favorite individuals, a celebrity, a sports figure, or a statesman, or something like that. And you know that not everything everywhere can be said about that individual. In fact, most people who have had a biography written about them have had multiple biographies written about them, and usually it's from different perspectives. If you have a sociologist writing a biography, you're going to have a certain take on that individual's life. If you have a theologian writing a biography, you're going to have another take on that person's life. It's the same with a historian or an economist or something like that. They're going to have their angles on that individual. It's the same with the Gospels. Matthew, writing primarily to a Jewish audience, is going to be selective in his material. So unlike Luke, who doesn't have the angels singing from the realms of glory, who doesn't have the shepherds, instead, promoting and keeping his agenda, if you please, moves us forward 1 to 2 years later. So the end of chapter 1 finds us Joseph waking from his sleep, doing as the angel commanded, Mary gives birth, and they call his name Jesus. Hard stop. The very next verse, now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in the days of Herod, we move the narrative forward. And we know that it's 1 to 2 years for internal reasons, and I'll show them to you in just a moment. So 1 to 2 years later, now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, there's Matthew's behold. I told you that 6 times he beholds us in Matthew 1 and 2. It's an arrest. It's a stop. Behold, I want you to look at this. Behold it. Hold it. Look at it. Turn it like a diamond so that you can see the facets of it and you can see the richness of what it is that I'm doing here, says Matthew. Behold, wise men, magi really are better. Magi as in magician, astrologer, magi from the east came to Jerusalem saying, where is he who has been born King of the Jews, for we have seen a star when it rose and have come to worship him. Now, notice how Matthew sets the stage for us. That little word now, not translated by all English translations. I really wish they'd do that because Matthew and the other gospel writers pay attention to time. There's a sequence here. So the word now is a marker for us. Okay, this has happened. Pause. Now, he's intentionally setting scenes for us. Now, after Jesus was born, setting the stage in Bethlehem of Judea and in the days of Herod the king. So those who were reading this or hearing this read to them would automatically have some frame in their mind. Okay, I know where this is geographically. Ooh, and in the time of King Herod, so-called the Great, automatically begins to tell us stuff about the situation as well. I'll withhold the information on King Herod for just a moment, but he is one of the Bible's despicable characters, to say the very least. So this is the setting that Matthew's laying out for us, and then he hits us with the behold. Behold, magi, like I said, astrologers or magicians from the east, very intentional from the east, signaling to us that these are foreigners. These are not at home people. So automatically now, we've got this expanding missionary perspective that Matthew's infusing with this story that he's telling us. Interestingly enough, that this one is born king of the Jews, but in comes a non-Jew and a pagan through and through, if you please, automatically creating ruffles. Automatically ripples in the water here because these are unclean people. These are people that are not worthy of the gospel. Which is what some blue bloods would have been saying, and maybe even some of you in the room think that there are some people who are just too dirty to receive Jesus. They're from the wrong country. They have the wrong job, or no job. Matthew's saying, right here, right now, I'm going to lay it out. And then, I'm going to close my gospel by saying, go and make disciples of all the nations. All of them. No exceptions. To the least of these. Behold, wise men, astrologers from the east, foreigners, probably from Babylon. We don't know. Babylon, huh? Babylon. You know, the Babylon whore in Revelation, loathed, destroying the people of God, all in keeping with Matthew's mission to all of the nations. Now, it gets very fascinating because here they are. They arrive just out of nowhere. Here they are. Where is he who was born king of the Jews? The first thing that strikes me in reading this is, well, wait a minute. When did you get that information? So what we know about them is that they're pagan astrologers, magicians. They're from a dirty country. They show up and they say, "Yoo-hoo, where's the king of the Jews?" I mean, there's so much not told to us right there. But somehow, I'm assuming by some sort of revelation, they know this. They've been looking into their books. They've been figuring out the stars. They've been looking into the pools of water that astrologers did back then and tried to figure out how all these... Mind you now, these are not dumb people. These are people who have their act together and know how to put things together and read the signs of the times, if you please. But here we have a title for Jesus. He's born King of the Jews. Matthew wants to make it very clear that that title gets put on Jesus, the Christ, the one we've already known by those names up to this point in time, born King of the Jews. But here, on the mouths of these pagan astrologers, King of the Jews, we want to see him. For we saw his star when it rose. That's a loaded term. It's a loaded term. These are stargazers. They're astrologers. They're fortune tellers, you know, like the ones on Highland Boulevard that you can pay $10 and they'll tell you what you're going to have for lunch tomorrow morning, tomorrow afternoon. We ought not to laugh about that. There's such a thing as black magic and the dark arts. Yes, they can tell you some things because they're in touch with resources that are terrifying. For we saw his star when it rose. So they have some knowledge that something's happening and they can see it in the stars. Now, it suggests that they know at least a little bit of the ancient sacred scriptures. They probably knew them all. They probably had stacks of books, parchments, manuscripts that had all of the different religious prophecies in them and to puzzle over them and to figure it out. This might all be part of it, and they would have known well, particularly first century people hearing that the star rises. If they had known their Bibles, they might have thought something was said about this a little earlier. Where was that? Balaam, Numbers 24:17. Balaam's oracle is a rather interesting piece that fits right in here, because Balaam is going to prophesy, if you please, in Numbers 24:17, that a star will come out of Jacob. So they're putting that together. They're doing a decent job of putting the sacred scriptures together. This is what I am referring to as general revelation. The word, in quotation marks, the word, not the saving word, but the word of nature. Nature testifies to God, if particularly you have eyes to see. The writers, and you've already heard me preach this, it was a couple of years ago now, in Romans chapter 1, Paul puts the theology on this together for us in Romans chapter 1 and verse 19. For what can be known about God is plain to them, unbelievers, because God has shown it to them. Well, tell us more, Paul. Romans 1:20. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. General revelation cannot save you, but it can indict you. In other words, Paul's argument from nature is that you should be so awestruck by that sun coming up over the horizon that you want to videotape that so you can watch it again and again and again. It ought to make you wonder, is there something going on here that I don't know about? This is what's going on right here. In a star. I have a book on my shelf at home. It's a beautiful book. Beautiful book. written by a guy I went to seminary with. It is the single authoritative work on the Great Christ Comet. It's an astounding work that this guy that I used to sit in class with would have a mind that could grab all of the world of astronomy and all of the world of theology and bring them together and make an argument for what exactly this star was is absolutely breathtaking. It's breathtaking. I got 3 pages of it read. Okay, so I read 3 pages so I can use it as an illustration. Point is, for those of you who have an apologetic bent, we don't have to blush here. There's no need to be embarrassed here. We don't want to just simply say it was a miracle, but it was. But I just wanted to let you know that there are good people who are on our side, if you please, who have written 300-page volumes with illustrations declaring this might very well have been what has happened. It's peer-reviewed and accepted across the board. But the star isn't the star of the story. The star of the story has meaning because it points someone to someone. We have seen his star. Balaam gave us a heads up on that when he said that a star will come out of Jacob. Now, here's the contrasts. Two contrasting responses as we see throughout the pattern of Matthew. And the response of the determined magi is in verse 2 of Matthew chapter 2 that says, "We have saw his star when it rose," or when it was rising in the east, "and we have come to worship him." They've been waiting, they've been looking, they've been watching, and now they've come to worship him. Now, your first reaction is, okay, what do you mean by worship? What does a fortune-telling foreigner mean by wanting to find this king of the Jews so they can worship him? What in the world does that mean? Because worship has got an extraordinarily wide range of meanings. Everybody worships. Everybody. Every human being ever created is a worshiper. The question is, what is it you and they and we worship? Nobody is not a worshiper. So you've got this dynamic going on. We've come to worship him. Now, I'm going to hold that out here because they're going to answer that question for us real soon. But notice now the response of the deceptive king. Response of the determined magi, we want to worship him. Now, here's the response of the deceptive king. When Herod, verse 3, Herod the king heard this, he was troubled. That's absolutely not strong enough. He was terrified. His mind was agitated. It's a deep word. He's coming unglued. And all Jerusalem with him. That's a very interesting statement. Why was all Jerusalem terrified as well? They weren't necessarily terrified of the one born king of the Jews. Their terror was coming from what this nut job king was going to do with the information he was about to find out. When you're under the guidance of a tyrant, you're paying very careful attention to that individual. Because if that individual gets up on a hobby horse that makes you uncomfortable, it doesn't bode well for the people underneath that tyrant. So they're all anxious about this. So he assembles, having the power that he does, he assembles all the chief priests, going on to verse 4, all the chief priests and the scribes of the people. This is power. He can just whistle and brings everybody together. He calls his cabinet in and he wants the information. And he inquires of them, verse 4, where the Christ, very interesting that Herod will not call him the king. He calls him the Christ, even though he's been announced as the king of the Jews. Where is the Christ? The fact that he gives them the Christ is an interesting thing in and of itself. That Herod is willing to say Messiah is a very interesting point here. We won't belabor it. He inquired of them where the Christ, not the king, was to be born. Verse 5, they told him. So the assembly's there. This is their job. They should have this at hand, and they do. They've got their briefs. They got what they need. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people. So this is what they told King Herod the Great. in Bethlehem. He's to be born in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet. This is a quote from Micah, chapter 5. He's a contemporary of Hosea and Isaiah. Part of the reason why Tom is leading us in corporate readings of the prophets is because all of the prophets that we're reading corporately are incorporated in the Matthew 1 and 2 preaching that I'm doing over Advent. So that you're seeing how Matthew puts his Bible together. And so you too can pick up these threads through the prophets and how it is that they all pointed to Jesus. And the New Testament community saw that and put it together. So this is what Micah 5, 2 says. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, this is verse 6 now of Matthew 2, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. So you might be small, but don't worry about it. Big things are going to happen to you. So prophesies Micah, for from you shall come. Now here's more words describing this one. He is going to be a ruler, a king, if you please, who will shepherd. Interestingly enough, a king who will shepherd. That's an oxymoron. Kings don't go out in fields and step in sheep doo-doo. This one is going to. So says the prophet, he shall, from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. But we also know that it's beyond my people Israel. It's important to realize the context of Micah chapter 5 because the context comes with these passages. They're not just willy-nilly plucked out of nowhere. The context of Micah 5 is profound. Shepherd king coming from the line of David who will bring hope not only to Israel but also to the nations. And he'll do so, watch this now, he'll do so, according to Micah 5:15, by executing vengeance on the nations that did not obey. Oh, first century church, Jewish church especially, love that. Amen. Bring the Christ and let him come with all of his vengeance and throttle Rome. That didn't quite work out the way they wanted it to. You know how the story goes from there. Sort of like how our story goes when Jesus doesn't do what we want him to do. So here's King Herod. Given the label, the Great. Why? Because economic times were booming under his guidance. It's amazing. It's amazing how much can be overlooked when the economy is going well. Building programs, theaters being developed. He rebuilds the temple. Rome loves this appointment. And they look the other way at his paranoia because not only has he killed his wife, but he's killed at least two of his sons and other family members because he perceived them to be a threat to his throne. And so he's called great. This is Herod the Great, appointed by Rome. He's terrified because somebody else, a baby, is being called king. Herod, we're not done with Herod yet. Herod, verse 7, now calls for a second meeting. This time he's going to go get the source. So Herod summons the Magi secretly. And ascertains from them what time the star had appeared. So he's got the prophets, the priests and the scribes quoting scripture to him. That's special revelation. That's the word of God given as directly from the mouth of God. That's what converts. That's what needs to be preached in order for you to be saved. This is the summary, the full summary of Psalm 19, is it not? The first half of Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. All of creation speaks for God, but it does not convert. Then the second half of Psalm 19, but the word of God, that is what preaches. That is what converts. And this is what you have going on right here. Matthew's showing this to us. Nature draws us to God. Salvation comes through the proclaimed word of God. And that's what he's showing us in balance here. Herod now, having received this word, summons the Magi. He's going to go right to the source. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, verse 8, go and search diligently for the child, and when you found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. Yeah, and everybody in the room snickers because they can see right through that. But here he is, with the power that he has, feeling threatened, calling in secret meetings, getting all the information that he needs, and then moving people around to his advantage and putting a veneer on it and saying, well, I want to know too because I want to go worship him just like you do. That's why, did I not say just a few minutes ago that worship has a rather large range of meaning? We get the sense that the Magi really mean it. We get zero sense that Herod the Great is going to submit to anybody. So we begin to ask the question, who is Jesus? Who is Jesus to you? We don't know yet about the Magi. We're still putting that together. But we're beginning to put it together fairly easily here with Herod the Great. For the fear-based, deceptive pseudo-king, Jesus is a threat. Has Jesus ever been a threat to you? Probably pre-conversion. When you really began to understand who Jesus was and the demands that he made of your life, did he threaten you? Was that a threat? Like, this is threatening to my lifestyle. This is threatening to what I hold dearly. Like, wow, if he is the king and he makes these legitimate demands of me, that means I'm not going to be able to do this anymore. I'm not going to be able to hold on to that anymore. I'm going to have to let that go. See, and that's what people think Christianity is all about. It's all negative, what you can't do, what you can't have. That's only one side of the coin. Because Jesus is a threat. He's a threat to your entire lifestyle. And if he poses no threat at all, then we legitimately have to ask ourselves whether or not he's the king. Because you don't broker with kings. They're monarchs. They declare. There's no debate. But we debate, don't we? Jesus, I'll go this far. But don't make me go to Africa. Don't make me have to quit my job. Now watch by contrast the response, second response of the determined, or the unpacked response of the determined Magi. After listening to the king, verse 9, I love that little line Matthew put, after listening to the king, I don't know, I know it's reading in, but there's part of me that sits there and thinks that the three of them saw right through King Herod the Great, and they're sitting there just, we're listening. Then they walk out of the meeting. They close the door. Yeah, he wants to worship him like we do. And behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them. This is why I describe this as a journey along God's providential pathway. Like in the Old Testament, when the people of God followed the cloud, the pillar of fire, here is a celestial miracle that's occurring that is guiding, earnestly seeking people to find the king. It is absolutely amazing to think about the ends that God will go to get you to the king. It's in your testimony, isn't it? I was going this way, and then this happened. I was thinking this was my life, and then this happened. When they saw the star, they rejoiced. Verse 10. No, they didn't. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly. No, they didn't. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. Do you get it? Do you get it? I sat back in my office yesterday. I literally laughed. Because I'm looking at it in the original language. And one word, and then there's another word, and there's another word. This is not embellishment right here. Matthew describes this with three separate words. He could have just said, and they rejoiced. And I still would be waving my arms and sweating and spitting all over you. And they rejoiced. And I would have done the exact same thing if they had rejoiced exceedingly. But they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. I mean, what else can you say? And it makes me want that. I'm thinking, really, three times, rejoice, rejoice exceedingly, rejoice with great joy. When was the last time you and I ever did anything like that? I mean, I've got examples where I rejoiced, maybe even rejoiced like over the top, but over the top, over the top. This is like Tom Bosel rejoicing. This is all Boseling Bosel. But do think about it. And I pray for that. The revelation of Jesus Christ. This isn't about me guilting you, thinking, oh, you know, the first time you discovered Jesus, this is what should have been your experience. I'm not saying that. It is theirs. But is there any wonder in our lives? Is there any exceeding rejoicing over the birth, over the person of Jesus? Or have you been so dulled? Have I been so dulled that nothing about him excites me, like fires me up? Like, this is better than rooting for your team, as nuts as you can be in your living room. We can't be nuts in the sanctuary because everybody will think we're crazy. So what? So what? Be crazy for Jesus. I think Matthew pokes at us a little bit. I think he does. They rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. We don't even know yet if they're believers. The sheer thrill of the discovery. And maybe for them it's been a lifelong pursuit of all of their books and finally all this hard work, and they're now seeing their treasure. You know what that's like. A job you've worked hard at for years and years and years coming to fulfillment. You run out of the workplace. Honey, it's done. We've succeeded. It's out in the marketplace. Let's go out for dinner tonight. Let's call the family. Go for dinner tonight. I found Jesus. Let's go. Going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother. They fell down and they worshiped him. Matthew says absolutely nothing that would make us think that that's anything other than a heart overcome with the majesty of Jesus. There's no indication whatsoever that this is fake. This is a pursuit, and they've found what they've looked for. Then, verse 11, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. I love the way that Ashton read that verse. I don't know if she did it on purpose or not, but she put just a little bit of inflection on the word then, and it's exactly right. It's exactly right. And here's the reason why I'm making a big point out of this, and a big point out of the timing language. Nows and thens. There's a sequence. What Matthew wants us to see is the sequence. They worshiped before they gave. It's not reversed. God doesn't want or need your gifts if you think it's going to earn favor with Him. He wants you on your face worshiping Him. And is that not the only appropriate response to a real king? And then they offered their gifts. So don't come to church and think, big fat check, point for me in God's books. The Old Testament prophets rail against people that exhibit that kind of what they call false worship. Am I satisfied with 10,000 offerings and your heart is still far from me? Let's get it straight. Christmas is about worshiping Jesus. The present sharing, the gift giving, ought to be a reflection of that. They opened their treasures. They were literally treasure boxes. They offered Him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. Way too much ink has been spilled on the meaning of all three of those gifts. This is also the assumption that there were three magi. We don't know how many magi there were. The assumption is that there were three because there are three gifts. I want to think that Matthew's winking and that when we get to heaven, we find out that there were 22 magi. And the three that went forward were representing groups of seven or something like that. Could be. The fact of the matter is that they sought, they found, they worshiped. God drew them. The providential pathways. You all have them in your life. If your life is safe and secure in Jesus right now, you have followed a providential pathway to get home. And as I quoted, I think it was last week, the Portuguese proverb, that God draws straight with crooked lines. There's not one story in this room, and I don't even need to know you that well, there's not one story in this room that's a direct, straight line. Human experience requires detours. But it's all part of God's providential pathways. You may be in one of those detours right now, scoffing at what I'm saying, thinking, some providence this is. I've been a pastor long enough to slow down because I've been there and I've been with people in those seemingly unending detours and have had to very, very carefully walk with that person before I got anywhere near being able to tell them that they were on the providential pathway to what God had for them. We do grave counseling danger. Grave danger, particularly to the mentally ill, when we just tell people that God is sovereign and has a wonderful plan for your life. You hear me say repeatedly from this pulpit, Job's friends had it exactly right. And then they opened their mouths. One of the banners that flies over the Ronsley household, two words, empathy first. We don't steal one another's stories. You're having a root canal tomorrow. Don't tell the person who just told you they're having a root canal tomorrow about how horrible your root canal was 2 years ago. They want your empathy and your prayers. They don't want to become the one who has to listen to your grief. They're grieving and have little capacity to grieve for you. Empathy first. for the fear-based, deceptive pseudo-king, Jesus is a threat. For the joy-based, courageously seeking magi, Jesus is a treasure. That's what Matthew wants us to look right at. Threat, treasure. A threat to our comfortable way of life. A treasure that, regardless of the cost, we will pursue. A story came to my mind in the middle of the night at my former church. We housed mission teams, sometimes for extended periods of time. They could do training. We worked an awful lot with YWAM, Youth with a Mission. And I'll never, ever forget the zeal of some of these missionaries that came in to do training. I've never seen anything like it in my life. There was one guy who did a training for the young missionaries to be in the basement of the church. And then he disappeared for the night. Didn't know what was going on. He came back the following morning, having been up all night. And he didn't want to share the story, but we drew it out of him. He had gone almost all by foot to the northernmost tip of Queens from Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, to find one man, to give him one Bible that had finally been translated into that man's language. I wept then, and I weep now, because it's a standing rebuke to my comfort level. He went without sleep after having given training all day to find one man to give him one Bible that he finally could get in his own language, and then made it all the way back before the sun came up to engage these young missionaries for breakfast. The 72nd Psalm, verse 11, will declare, "May all the kings fall down before him, all nations serve him." See, this is the beginning. This is what Matthew's doing. The magi are the front end. The magi, see it, please. See the parade. See the long line of people now for some 2,000 years, church. The magi. The front end of the fulfillment of prophecy of those who will come from all the nations to worship this king. And you're in that parade. And you're in that parade. And so are the magi. And one day you will see them. And you will ask them the questions that you want. And you'll see Isaiah, who also prophesied in the 60th chapter of his prophecy in the third verse, "All nations shall come to Israel's light and the kings to the brightness of your rising." Matthew is making it very clear that Jesus is the true Israel and he is now here. And he is the light that draws. All nations will be drawn to that light because he is the one that is bright. He is the one that has risen. He is the one that has been sent to the nations. This is the one that has been born King of the Jews. And this is what Matthew wants us to see in these three magi. I want you to be in the parade. I want you to be in the reveal party. You've seen the revelation. You've heard the revelation preached to you week after week after week. Does it cause you to rejoice? Or does it threaten you? Are you drawing parameters around the ends to which you will go in order to get Jesus? It's a sobering text. It's an Advent text. It's a text brimming with violence and pseudo-kings who thinks they're going to put an end to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. I love what John Piper has written in the devotional, if you're reading it, and he said it this week. God wields, I love this. God wields the world and the word to see that his son is worshiped. Meditate upon that sentence this coming week. God wielded the world to get men to worship his son Jesus. There's precious little he won't do to get you. When I step back and think of all of God's providence and him celestially arranging a star so that foreigners from wicked Babylon with pagan backgrounds and cultures to come to Christ, who am I to judge another race? Who am I to judge to say that person from that country is not worthy? When God moves stars to bring people to a saving knowledge. Let's be done away with that stuff. Tension yet remains, then and now. You can see the tension in my face, knowing the barricades that are put up around the people groups that are coming to this country. Because Jesus is drawing them. Read Acts 17. The boundaries and the places where you live have been providentially determined by God in this day and age for the express purpose to lead others to Jesus and Jesus worship. This is what we're about. It's not about immigration policy and putting up walls. It's about getting the people that are coming to this country and saving them with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Let's look at it like Christians. The coming of Christ, it appears, is not all calm and all is bright. Verse 12 leaves us hanging, hanging. Those who are serving communion, please get yourself ready. Being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. See, they knew. And God, providentially determining the pathways, spoke to them like he did Joseph, spoke to them in a dream and said, don't go back. Go another way. So here's the question. How do you think Herod took that news when he found out about it? Next week, God willing, is not for the faint of heart. It is part of our story. It is tied up with Advent and Christmas and the coming of Jesus. It's exceedingly violent. Matthew will sugarcoat nothing. And he will put our Savior in a faraway place. Pretty poignantly making the point that Jesus, himself a refugee, is the Savior of refugees. Despite seemingly insurmountable threats from powerful, maniacal, hell-bent political leaders, God's providential pathways will not, indeed cannot, be thwarted. Nothing will keep God from getting his word to all the nations. Nothing will keep God from getting his word to all of the nations for the express purpose that they might worship the object of that word. Missions exists because worship doesn't. Jesus is the Christ. He is the ruling shepherd. He is the one born King of the Jews and King of every nation. Let us bow and worship him. Our Father, you would inspire Paul to write that we are not to be conformed to the pattern of this age. In the hearing of the saints, I readily confess to you, Father, how much this passage exposed my conformity to the pattern of this age. It made me incredibly uncomfortable. It's still making me uncomfortable. I pray that wherever Jesus is a threat to my well-being and my way of living, that in the days and weeks and months and years to come, you would reverse that so that Jesus becomes increasingly my treasure. for whom nothing is too extreme. Even if I lose friends in the meantime, even if I'm thought to have some sort of something, I pray, and you know that I do, God, I pray for the souls in this room. How I long for them to treasure Jesus. But it has been well said that the tide can only rise so high. Let it be, Father, that you build within me and the elders of this church a passion for Jesus that becomes an inspiration for everyone who enters into this building. Let us take stock in this holy season, which is what Advent is for. Let us take stock, even regarding the emotions that we're experiencing right this second, and ask whether or not they're submitted to you and to the truth of your word.